Season 5, Episode 9, Lost Israel Part 2. Before we start, if you're watching this on Hulu, you're getting an edited version of the episode. I watched this episode twice before figuring out it's not the full episode. You may notice when you watch it that the transitions are weird and fast. You might notice that Fancy is barely in it. You might notice that Martinez, Medavoy, and Kirkendall are in it for 1.5 scenes. But if you look at the description of the episode on Hulu, it includes a whole nother investigation that isn't in the episode at all. I didn't do any, like, straight-up research because I was trying to just watch the full episode. And when I was looking around on Wikipedia and things like that, it would include that this extra investigation is a part of the episode, but it isn't in the episode on Hulu. As it turns out, it seems like this episode was a special one-hour episode of NYPD Blue. So if you watch the full thing, it's an hour long. However, on Hulu, they have an edited-for-TV version that is only 40 minutes. I found this out because I kept seeing the description, it was driving me crazy, and looking up online, it was driving me crazy, and I pulled out the old DVDs. And sure enough, the old DVDs we have has the full hour version that includes the extra investigation that Medavoy Martinez and Jill Kirkendall are on that I will mention after we get through all of Lost Israel. But that is why this episode might go long, and I have a full 2 pages of notes because it's an hour-long episode.
Oh, okay. Really? This makes me wonder, did Amazon have the full one?
I don't know, and we'll never know, because Amazon no longer has the show up. Well, unless someone watched it on that.
So I may not have seen every episode of NYPD Blue, then.
What I'm trying to figure out is why.
Yeah, where's the footage?
And the only thing I could come up with as to what may have happened is, I think because the show is syndicated, and it's been mentioned on Twitter that with syndication, like, you're allowed to cut the episode how you want to fit your commercials.
Uh-huh.
So, like, on TNT or Court TV, they'll cut out parts of scenes to get their commercials in.
Interesting.
And I think what may have happened is Hulu has the version of Lost Israel Part 2 that's to fit an hour format of a show, even though that episode aired either without commercials or for an hour and a half when it originally aired. So
yeah.
I think Hulu only may have, because every episode of the show is obviously enhanced for HD. Because if you watch this shit on DVD, it's in square format and it looks like absolute dog shit because it was made in the 90s. But if you watch on Hulu, they've kind of cleaned it up, and I think they only cleaned up the 45-minute version one.
Oh, interesting. I get what you're saying. Okay.
Because when you watch it on the, because when I watched it on the DVD, I was like, man, this is rough to watch. Just the way it hits your eye now, because we're so used to perfect HD quality. It's kind of like when you're watching, like everybody else is, I assume, The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan Bulls documentary, and they cut to the old footage of games, and you're like, fuck, we used to watch games that look like this? The whole disclaimer is to allow people who listen to our show and who watch NYPD Blue to know it might be very confusing, because I did all of my notes, and I imagine we'll do this episode, basically, not even mentioning the other one, and then just kind of tacking it on to the end, because I'm guessing you, Kyle, only watch the one on Hulu?
Yeah, I haven't used the Amazon Prime one in years, so I don't remember. And I don't think I have watched this one on the DVD.
So,
yeah.
It's very strange also when you watch the full episode that there's no transitions, really. It just is like scene, cut, scene. And
it's only them.
It's only them. It's only them dealing with these people. And then there is one scene in this edited version that crosses over with the other investigation, that makes that scene make absolutely no sense, but we just go with it. And I'll explain when we get there. Lost Israel Part 2, the abridged version, and then I'll explain what happened in the other one, even
the
though
abridged version.
Even though it doesn't really matter what happened in that second one. When we open on Lost Israel Part 2, Sipowicz is in early with a Bible in hand because he researched the passage that Israel gave him when he went home. He's in early to check on him, and he tells Shannon, the uniform officer who was looking after him through the night, that the passage that Israel gave him actually is about a boy who went out with his father, got hurt, and then died at his home. And then they tried to bring a holy man to bring him back to life. Shannon, because he doesn't understand the full story, is kind of just like, okay. And Sipowicz realizes that he won't match his enthusiasm. So he jokingly says he probably didn't keep you up with conversation. And he goes in to see Israel, and Israel has hung himself.
And then he asks him about Israel, like, and how he was during the night, you know? Like, that's what's weird.
He was like, yeah, like, he said he worked out okay. He's like, yeah, he's fine. And then when he sees him like that, he cuts him down and he tries to do CPR. He gets super pissed at Shannon because he's like, how long did you leave him here? And he's like, only like 2 hours. He wasn't on suicide watch and he wasn't a prisoner.
Oh, that is true. They were trying to make it so that he wasn't, like, he didn't feel like he was in jail.
Sipowicz notices that he had a passage open next to his bed. So, Sipowicz kind of grabs that Bible, and that's the beginning of the episode. We then go into the theme song. This is NYPD Blue Balls, where I, Kirk, and the other voice, Kyle, talk about every single episode of NYPD Blue to the best of our ability, if Hulu has the full version. This is the and this is the theme song to NYPD Blue.
What got here?
I mean, I've already talked about it, but you don't understand how maddening it was when I saw the description of this episode, and like the second half of the description and the like little blurb. I'm like, we don't even talk to Medavoy. How does he have a case? And then I'm like looking online, and I'm like, what the fuck is everybody talking about? He's not even in this episode. And then going to the DVD and going, oh shit, we've been bamboozled by Big Hulu. They didn't do it on purpose, I'm sure.
Do you think they even know?
Probably not. Why would they? Like, there's no... Because I even wrote on the Asher Brothers podcast Twitter, I was like, I just figured this out and I can't believe it. It's so weird. Hulu didn't respond, even though I tagged them in it. So I don't think they would know and or care that it's happening. When we cut back, Sipowicz is obsessed with the Bible passage. The only time we see Martinez and Medavoy and Kirkendall in the background of this episode is Martinez says to Sipowicz, I'm sorry about that guy, Andy. Sipowicz says that guy was no dope, and I just got to figure out what he meant by this. Russell and Simone, because Fancy isn't there, which we don't know why he's not there, which would have been explained if we had the transitions of this episode, but Fancy isn't there, so Simone asks Sipowicz.
Okay, keep going, just keep going.
What I plan to do is to go through the episode as it is, and then at the end of it, go through all the stuff that was cut out.
Okay.
Because it is interesting, and it helps us understand why it's really weird to watch this episode cut. Simone asks, what do we tell the Egans? Do we tell them that Israel has died? And Sipowicz says, I don't know. And he's like, well, does Egan's wife, Sherry, does she bottle up even more once they find out that this guy killed himself? And Sipowicz says, no, you land hard on the investigation staying open. And he's like, on what, Andy? And Andy just looks up and says, lie. Tell him there's new evidence.
Yeah.
Lie.
That's when you kind of know, like, Andy doesn't know what to do.
And he's just like, he's freaking out reading this Bible. Because once he realized that Israel gave him something that is way more profound. He's like, this guy knows what's going on. He's going to let us know what to do. When really, I think Israel was just giving a passage that was kind of like his suicide note.
Yeah, it's really sad. True.
Simone and Russell go to the Egan's, where their lawyer is present and tells them that Israel died, but the investigation is still open. The lawyer and Steve both think that the suicide is a confession.
Yeah, they're really landing hard on that throughout the whole episode.
And Simone says, well, you could take it that way, and Steve freaks the fuck out and says, which other way would you take it? Another victim by our callous society. He's like, that's what got Brian killed, that soft-bellied liberal puke. And I was like, yeah, MAGA, bro, you fucking idiot.
Yeah, incel, like, dog, incel.
that damn cuck Israel. So,
wow.
So then Simone, just to get underneath Steve's skin, he says he's got a housekeeping question about when he took him out to see where Israel lived and found Brian's shirt. And he said, oh, the place where we found Brian's bloody shirt. And he's like, well, you found Brian's bloody shirt. And then Steve was like, I wanted to spare you the embarrassment of being reminded.
And it's like, dude, Steve's coming hard.
Steve's going way hard, knowing that the investigation's still open.
I think because he feels like he's gotten away with it.
Simone lets him know, someone says that they saw another person on that stoop earlier that day who more or less fits your description and wanted to make sure that you were not there any time earlier. And Steve is clearly agitated. He says things like, how many people in Manhattan more or less fit my description?
He's not wrong there.
And then, like, during all this agitation and back and forth, Russell is just watching Sherry and, like, seeing how she's reacting to everything, and even asks her, hey, Sherry, do you think there's anybody that would do this? Try and throw suspicion onto Israel? And she just stays quiet, and then the lawyer, who's smelling what's going on here, is like, I think we're done here, and I think you're going to notify me anytime you speak to the Egan's.
It's the one time the lawyer, like, does his job.
And Simone even says, like, well, of course, I assume they would want you here even if we didn't call you. And he goes, no, I want you to contact me every time you plan to talk to them.
Yeah.
And then when Sherry says, well, let us know what's going on, the lawyer is like, I want to know about that too. And Steve freaks out and says, what did the lawyer just say? I mean, this is time to mention that they wasted a perfectly good cup of coffee and tea because they left before they could drink it.
They do that a lot, though, on this show.
They just leave wasted beverages.
So when they go into houses or apartments, a lot of times someone will be like, hey, can I get you something?
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the time they'll be like, sometimes they'll say no, but I feel like they just have them say yes sometimes, so it makes them feel like they're more human, you know? Like, yeah, sure, I'll take a cup of coffee, like, we're going to sit here and talk. But because it's a TV show and the scenes can't be that long, by the time the coffee comes, the scene's over and they just leave, you know? And you're just supposed to be like, oh, all right, whatever. And you move on with it. I don't know. I just find it. They do it a lot on this show. It's interesting.
Yeah, I wonder if anyone's done the work to figure out, like, how many gallons of wasted beverage because of saying yes, knowing that they won't be able to drink it. And wasted booze from when, like, Christopher Maloney was trying to pump drinks into Russell.
Yeah, right?
A lot of wasted beverages. NYPD Blue, wasting beverages. That scene ends with Russell kind of saying to Sherry, like, we're here to help always with whatever you need. And then, weirdly, Simone pulls the same thing for Steve before leaving.
Yeah.
Before he gets out the door, he's like, look, man, I respect you handling this, and I apologize. We just have to work through everything in the investigation before we can close it. And then Steve kind of gives this face that's like, you know what, good buddy? Thanks. Like, I can't describe it, but it's like a half smirk where it's like, you know what? I should be respected for how I'm handling this. Because you're right.
I think that's all part of Simone's plan.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he's definitely trying to win back favor because it didn't go well when they came in there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's trying to make him feel like he got away with it, basically, and that he's on his side.
The next scene, the very next scene, Sipowicz and Simone are in the bathroom, and Simone's taking a piss. And Simone lets him know, like, what kind of lie he gave him, and Sipowicz said, that's good, it'll keep it open for the wife to come forward. And he mentions how he's struggling to figure out what the point of Psalm 119 is. And Simone is like, maybe we should get a Bible expert. And Sipowicz is like, nah, it's fine. And then Russell bursts in, and Simone kind of gives a whoa. And Sipowicz is like, what, is she seeing something fresh? And I was like, oh, a good dick joke in the middle of this very dramatic episode. She's seeing something fresh? Because we know she's been seeing that dick.
It's always time for a good dick joke, dude.
They luck out because the mother, Sherry, contacted Russell directly and wants to meet alone. Sipowicz is like, there's your in. And, like, immediately we cut to the diner. At the diner, Sherry comes in looking like she's hiding from the paparazzi. Like, covered up.
Yeah.
And at this point I wrote, it seems that Steve's a little controlling. Because Sherry mentions they have to go there because it's one of the few places that Steve would let her go alone. If she was staying anywhere else, he would go with her. It's clear that she's barely hanging by a thread. And
but, like, my whole point if I'm Sherry is, like, why not tell your husband, hey, I'm going to this diner, but then you tell Russell to meet you at a different diner?
That's a great question. I don't
you know.
Because at this point, we don't have cell phones that are as, like, even if they have a cell phone, it's not as intuitive or as, what's the phrase? They probably have beepers, if anything. But if they have them, it's not like he could call her and be like, where the fuck are you? If he happens to go down to the spot that she said she was going to. But, you know, that's Sherry not thinking straight. Because, you know, her son died and her husband, you know, was raping her son and then murdered him. And she doesn't want to admit it.
Allegedly.
Russell then goes through the very painful, slow process of trying to pull out this woman from fear. And
doesn't Andy say help her over?
He says that the next time when they go to where they find the shirt. But she's pulling her as hard as she can. And at one point, she brings up the fact that her dad died to a violent act because her mom shot him. Like, she brings up that her mom killed her dad. Which, I mean, obviously it helps with the scene. It helps her open up about what's happening and possibly get her to admit that what's happening is what's happening. But I wrote, wouldn't it be fucked up if she was lying about that? Like, it's,
I mean, they've had lied before about shit.
Like, it's convenient for this episode and the way it's written that Russell indeed had a situation where a family member killed another family member. But if she was just a cop where it's like, I need to convince this person to open up to me and then lied about that, how fucked up that would be?
That would be horrible, man.
And, because I was sitting there thinking, because we have another episode where a cop uses their personal experience based on this show from earlier episodes to talk to a suspect. And I was like, it's really convenient that they can do that with these characters, because if Russell didn't have that experience and was just like, well, you know, I lost a family member to violence from another family member and it was a lie, we would hate Russell for deceiving this person like that.
Very true.
She does say another fucked up thing where she's like, it's like, if I didn't admit what actually happened, it was like I was committing murder too. And I was like, is it really though? Is it really? And then I wrote down something that maybe you will agree with. After watching this scene the first time, I thought, is this mom a bad actress?
No, I started thinking that a lot too.
Like, I don't know if this is a very good job.
I don't want to spoil anything, but, like, later on, there's a scene where she, like, kind of turns into, like, a rabid animal.
She turns into Nicolas Cage.
She's like, argh!
Yeah. Argh! She really cages it later in this episode. This scene, right when it seems like she's gonna get her to talk about what's going on, Steve shows up And I wrote, Steve as a character is clearly smart enough to know what to say. Because he says things like, stop talking to her. And when Russell is like, why does she need your permission to leave the house? He's like, I don't need to give her permission. I just don't like being deceived.
Yeah.
I'm also on edge because a family member just died. I don't like people leaving the house to go to places I'm not aware of and deal with people I'm not aware of.
How many times is he going to go to that well? You know what I mean?
And then, like, when they go back and forth, he's like, look, you've got the man who did this. He passed judgment on himself. If you don't like that outcome, maybe you should have watched him better. Russell basically says,
in your face.
And then Russell says, like, I'm not going to stop Sherry unless you tell me to. And he goes, you interfering bitch, I would like you to hurt how he hurt. And she responds with, do you mean murder? Or, kill me, you mean. You got murder in you? That just made me wish I could shout, you got murder in you, as a question at someone. Like in the middle of a fight, just be like, you got murder in you? Like, I don't know, I just think that would be super badass. Steve catches himself before saying something more incriminating, like he just did. And he then, before they get in the car, he turns to Sherry and says, tell her to leave us alone, because he knows if she says it, then she has no right to stay with them.
Yeah, she can't keep bothering him.
Because he comes at him with, you should have notified the lawyer, and I think you're breaking the law, to which she said, no, your wife contacted me on her own, I don't have to notify him if she does that. He's saying all the right things. And then as she gets in the car and says, we're going home, she has a moment with Russell, and she's like, I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. I hear it loud and clear. And then the very next scene, after that crazy, angry, intense scene, it cuts to the house, and Steve Egan showed up to talk to Simone.
Yeah, like,
everything happens right away.
I don't understand why this man, though, keeps coming back and forth to the house. Like, why doesn't he at some point, like, try to just, like, stay away?
I think this scene right here is the thing that gets him fucked.
Okay.
I think if Steve Egan didn't go to Simone this time to talk to him about being abused himself, which is what happens, if he doesn't seek Simone's forgiveness and friendship, then it would be over. It would be all over. Because, essentially, this guy shows up without his lawyer, which is problem number one, if you want to get off of a murder charge.
Well, he starts to unravel, I think. I think what happens is, like, in the beginning, he's all buttoned up and has his shit together, but, like, that's him setting it up. It's not set up anymore. It's now, and now everything kind of has to be, like, improvised, and it can't, and everything's starting to unravel on him.
Steve Egan wants to talk to Simone. First, it seems like it's just going to be a bitch session. Like, why is Russell being contacted by my wife? Why is she putting ideas into her head? Blah, blah, blah. And Simone, he coolly and collectively is like, why don't we talk about it in here? And then Steve brings up the fact that he was abused at a sleepaway camp because he was a bedwetter, and then a counselor abused that trust. Simone then says, in the course of that admission and talk, he says that he was a bedwetter too, which made me question, is that true, or did he just say that to get in good with the dude?
Yeah.
Because I think people would be more forgiving in terms of a character on a show, like, oh, he lied about being a bedwetter versus Russell. She lied about her dad being shot by her mom.
I mean, though, but weren't we all bedwetters?
I don't know about you, man. My sheets will always be clean. I've never wet the bed.
I think we should call mom and dad on that one. I feel like everyone has peed the bed growing up once or twice.
Maybe. But I think
so bed, like, if in that case, I feel like, yeah, maybe, like, that's Simone right there. Like, Simone's maybe, Simone only peed once or twice in the bed. Whereas this dude was being molested, so he was peeing his bed till he was, like, 15. That's different.
Very different. He gets all this information out of him, and he's like, yeah, this obviously is hurting me more than my wife, because I had to deal with this too, and I know what Brian was going through, and I'm trying to keep it all together. And Simone is playing the, like, hey man, you gotta look out for yourself, you gotta talk about these things, you gotta be open with what happened and how you're taking it too, because you gotta worry about yourself sometimes. And then when they go to leave, he's like, "I want you to talk to me more, if you can." And he says, "I've got a lot out of talking to you, and it feels like there's more to say." And when the guy leaves, Simone basically runs up the stairs.
Yeah, he, like, sprints.
And when he runs upstairs, he, like, shouts, "The prick's jealous! He wants sympathy and attention!" And he tells them that he came out about being abused. Sipowicz was like, "Was he abused by his father?" And he's like, "No, a guy at a sleepaway camp." And Sipowicz says, "Never understood how people don't figure those places are asylums for perverts."
I don't know, you went to sleepaway camps. Did you feel like that?
No, because those were Christian perverts. They love those kids for Jesus. So, I have never heard of or knew of any pedophilic experiences at the Christian camps I went to. However, if they did occur, I'm sure that it happened with heterosexual relationships, because God would be more upset if they were gay. I'm sure that if they were going to engage in pedophilia, it would be with someone of the opposite gender to not anger God more. Because that's more important. Enough with the highbrow, lowbrow humor. Where was I?
He just told Simone he used to get diddled.
That's right.
Simone came up to and started talking about how he's jealous, and the guy is kind of jealous, like he can't just let it happen, like leave it be.
They both kind of reserved the idea, well, now we just have to wait to see who cracks first.
Yeah.
Because Russell doesn't want to go after the wife. She wants her to come to Russell. And
yeah, you can't be too pushy with the wife.
And Simone is like, "Well, I left the door open for him." And then Sipowicz is like, and they ask Sipowicz, like, "Did you see anything about next of kin for Israel?" And he freaks out because he's like, "Nope, there's nobody. I checked the shelters, I checked cars, I checked everybody. And he gave me this message, and I don't know what the hell it means." And he slams the Bible on the floor. And then a moment later, Sherry calls back, so he picks up the Bible and, like, strokes it. Like, as if the Bible throwing caused Sherry to call at that moment.
Yeah, like, God was like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa,
hey,
whoa.
Hey.
I didn't know you were that mad."
Okay, well, you know what? Let's have her call.
I didn't know that you were, like, throw my book mad.
Look, man, okay, look. You start throwing Bibles, then we'll start making things happen. You could have just prayed, but hey. You know, some people, you get them with vinegar rather than honey. She wants to meet Russell where they found the shirt. Russell then asks Bobby if he wants to show up to explain her husband's
action. Did you find that weird?
I didn't find it weird. I found what happened at the place weird. I didn't find it weird that they would bring Simone along, because I think they would have to know where to go.
No, did you find it weird that the mom wanted to go to the place where they found her dead son's shirt?
Kind of, yeah. I think it would have made sense more if she asked to go where he was found, rather than where the shirt was.
100%. That's what I thought, too.
But I think they did that to kind of hammer home the idea that Steve is the one that found the shirt, not Simone.
Fair enough.
When they go to talk to her, it's clear that everybody is a little excited, on edge, that they may have a foothold on this situation. And that's when Sipowicz says, "Help her over."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then the very next scene is they go to the spot. And while they're at the spot where Israel is supposedly living, Russell mentions this is where Steve found the shirt, and Sherry's like, "Steve is the one who found it," and she confirms with Simone, and Simone walks how he came down and walked over this direction, and then he says, "And your husband basically spotted it right away," which is not the truth. The husband kind of waited it out before pointing out where it was, but...
But he spotted it right away.
He did spot it right away.
But I mean, if you go rewatch that scene, how does Simone know he spots it right away if Simone's back's turned to him?
Exactly. Simone is kind of, you know, urging in a way there.
He's stretching truths a little.
And then what's really awkward about this scene is Well, I mean, what's really awkward is what happens after this part, but what's very weird to start is she starts playing this telephone game where she's like, I wanted to talk to you privately, and she's like, can Simone just, like, walk, like, 2 feet over there?
Yeah.
And then when
he asked a question, and then was like, could you ask Simone? It's like, that motherfucker was just standing right next to you.
And then there's this weird telephone game where it seems like, this is when I wrote, it seems like these scenes are a little indulgent of these people's acting abilities.
And then there was this weird part where, like, she, I don't remember the question, but she looks at Diane and is like, can you ask Simone this? And she's like, okay. And so she walks over to Simone and goes, Mrs. Egan would like me to ask you this.
Yeah. That's what, yeah.
And Simone, and then Simone answers it, and then Simone looks at Mrs. Egan and says, answers it the same way he answers it to Diane. Diane turned around, walked back, and went to Mrs. Egan and was like, Detective Simone says, yeah, he thinks it is.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, what?
Yeah, because she asked him, do you think that Steve could have put it there?
There you go.
And then he says to her, he's like, yes, that's a possibility. And then Russell goes down to walk in front of her and goes, yeah, Detective Simone thinks that's a possibility. It's like, yeah, she fucking heard it. She's right there.
Three fucking times. Like, it was amazing.
Then, like, she starts breaking down and she's like, and everything else. He would spend alone time with him because Brian would wet the bed. He said he was making him feel better. He also has his own room. He could have done it and then exited out that door.
So now that you have told me that this is edited down,
yeah,
I have to see the original version, because why I didn't like the second one compared to the first one so much is, like, I feel like all this, like, fucked up shit is being, like, brought to us in a very, like, and it's just fast. It's like Steve Egan sits down and it's like, I used to get diddled at camp and I peed my bed. And it was like, okay, boom. Then here comes Sherry. And then Sherry's like, yeah, he has his own way of getting into his room, and he was probably fingering my boy, and then blah, 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 and then blah, 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 blah. And it's like, all this shit is just, like, really, really fast.
really fast,
out of nowhere.
What's weird, and this is what makes this episode so fucking weird, is, like, it seems like these scenes are too long, but the series of events is happening so fast. Like, in a normal NYPD Blue scene, you have, like, 2 minutes, 2 to 3 minutes to convey a lot of information and act very fast. Where, like, an interrogation needs to happen and it has to hit these beats. And they write it very well. This one, it's like the scenes last 5 minutes, but they jump...
Yes, are real long.
But they jump to him so fast. So, like, okay, we gotta talk to this guy. Now we're talking to him. Now we're talking to his wife. Now this happens. Now we found this out. But the scenes themselves are so, like, drawn out, where you have a moment to ask yourself, like, are these bad actresses and actors? Because what happens is, Sherry is freaking out, and she goes, but there's no blood. There's no blood in Brian's room. There's no blood in his room. How did this happen? And then Russell, because this was a very smart move, Russell goes, well, he could have choked him at home and then beat his body down elsewhere. And so the mom, like, starts choking and freaking out. And then, for some reason, Steve shows up.
Yeah, why? Yeah, like, why is he there?
No idea.
Like,
no idea.
It's not even like where, like, someone else explains it, like, yeah, it's one of those things where he was just hanging out at the crime scene. Like, you know how they do that shit? Like, if someone's hanging out, then, like, later on in the episode, they're like, oh, that's why he was hanging out at the crime scene. Like, because he was a part of it and he needed to see what was going on. Like, shit like that, right?
Yeah.
None of that. It was just, like, all of a sudden she sees him, and then she turns into, like, a warlock.
Yeah!
Or a demon, and she's fucking just like,
crazy! At this moment, it's like, okay, this is, like, their big time to shine. This is how they win a guest Emmy nomination. I think she went way off book really fast. Because she's like, you tore him apart! Murderer!
Yeah.
Murder! And it's like, okay, alright, okay. Let's calm down. Like, I feel like what they should have done is, like, cut. we don't have all day, but you gotta tone it down.
I can't wait till we get to him.
But yeah, because then he's like,
he says the fucking words "my friend" like 900 times when Simone's interrogating him,
and she's like, "You tore him apart." And then he's like semi cool and collected, but he's kind of giving off this vibe like, oh fuck, cat's out of the bag, I'm fucked. And then at one point he randomly just shouts, "You didn't see anything like that," and spits all over himself.
Yeah.
And Simone grabs him and is like, no, we gotta go. And then Russell grabs Sherry and is like, "It's okay. He's not here anymore. He's not suffering." And she's like, "He's in heaven. He's gone and he's in heaven." Aww.
So Sherry, I didn't know that Sherry did the voice of Miss Jokes on Deck. What does he sound like right now? "He's gone. They're all gone. They're in heaven. They're gonna be... they're with Jesus."
So, the very next scene, because right after that, immediately, Simone and Steve are at Steve's apartment.
Yeah, immediately.
Immediately. And then...
immediately. No, like, time. Like, they, like, fucking teleported.
Steve, then, like, they're walking around, and... the phone is ringing off the hook, and Simone is like, "Hey, where's your housekeeper?" And he's like, "I let her go, all right? I fired her." Like,
yeah, which, what does that have to do? I didn't understand that plot point.
And then they sit on the couch, and Steve looks at Simone and goes, "What do we do?" Which I think Simone at that point is like, "Well, I got this fucker, if he's asking me what we should do." And Simone's like, I think you have to confront your wife's suspicions. And... or he first says, is like, "Why do you think she has them?" He's like, "I think Russell's been implanting them, and I need to know if you helped her." And Simone is like, "She just wanted to see where Brian's shirt was, and I wasn't badgering her at all." And then...
Simone's pretty smooth with it. Simone's really good at, like, spinning it around.
Oh, yeah, he dodges a lot of dodgeballs in this conversation, where he brings up, like, "Were you helping Russell?" And he's like, "No, she just wanted to see the area." Then he's like, I think you need to confront these suspicions. And this is when Steve says something that immediately would make me go, yeah, you obviously did something. He says, "There's no evidence, so how can it be refuted? If there's no evidence, it can be nothing but refuted, because there's no evidence." If someone comes at you with a baseless accusation, the lack of evidence is how you refute it. Like, you're talking nonsense. You're spitting crazy. Steve goes, like, "Is she just hanging her hat on this witness vagrant?" And then Steve realizes, because earlier in the first episode, part one, Simone says sometimes you make up evidence to get them to sweat. So then Steve goes, "Is this vagrant even real?" And Simone doubles down super hard and says, "Do you want to see him?" Which is ballsy as fuck.
That's very ballsy, because if he goes, "Yeah," what is he going to do?
Which he does. He goes, "Yeah, I want to evaluate him." And then maybe my...
really ballsy, though.
And then I want my lawyer to evaluate where he's coming from, because maybe he wants publicity. Because you know those vagrants looking for witness publicity.
Yeah, you know, all those vagrants looking to get on TMZ.
And I think Simone only did that to get him to the house. Because...
ooh, I like that.
I think Simone knows, if I get him in my house, in my territory, without his lawyer, shit is done. Like, I think Simone realizes, I've got him on the ropes. If I get him in the house without the lawyer, it's fucking overtime. It is. It's gonna be me and him toe-to-toe. And I'll figure out this vagrant thing later. I mean, we'll dress up Medavoy and tell him he's a vagrant.
Sure, they can do anything. They're the police. They can pretty much do anything.
And then what's very weird is they get up to walk out, and Steve looks at his ringing phone and says, "That's my lawyer now," and leaves it.
Well, another thing that's really fucking annoying about this scene is that the phone rings happens like nonstop, and it is super fucking loud.
And it's also crazy that Steve at no point goes, I should get my lawyer involved.
Or, like, unplug the phone or something. I don't know. Yeah, for a dude who, like, is unraveling and is, like, slowly getting to a point where it looks like you're going to go down for your kid's murder, he doesn't, yeah, he, like, just abandons his lawyer.
Yeah, fucking crazy. The second Simone walks in with Steve, Sipowicz, like, stands up, and Simone goes, hey, so, Steve wants to see that vagrant that saw him on, says he saw him on the stoop. And Sipowicz, like, slightly bad improv is like, okay. And Simone is like, can we set that up? And Sipowicz is like, sure. And Simone and Steve go to the observation room. And this is the one moment that the two investigations cross over if you knew there was a second investigation going on.
Yeah.
Because Sipowicz walks in with Jill talking with a man with his left hand missing, which they do not address. And they say, so is he going over with a sketch artist? And Jill pulls her super fast improv moves and tells the guy, hey, it's okay. Yeah, we're going over with the sketch artist now. Simone lets Steve see that, then turns off the intercom and brings down the shade. Because Steve be fucked.
And I think Simone sees the look on Steve's face, and I think he knows that Steve realizes that he's fucked too.
And Steve mentions, like, oh man, with the witness and Sipowicz's involvement, are they now crediting his suspicions on me? And he sees Simone as, like, a friend. Like, how are we gonna get out of this? And Simone is like, look, man, with all this, you're gonna have to confront these suspicions. And Steve almost immediately admits it, saying, like, if you think I'm going to change my plan, my friend, you're wrong. And then he says, if you think I'm making any changes, you can get out of my way.
He's fucking saying, my friend.
Oh, man. And then, for a very long time, Steve slowly breaks down until he admits.
How long of a time, Kirk?
A very, very long time. Because if this was a normal scene, it would have been less time for him to get to the point where he just admits that he murdered Brian. And he justifies it by saying, like, how would God not want this boy to be taken away if he's being abused by this monster and being hurt so much? And then he really chews up the screen time by doing this, like, shake and his eyes get wide. Almost like he just realized that he admitted to murder.
Yeah.
And then he puts his head back and he's like, just shoot me. Just kill me. And Simone goes, I can't. And kind of gives him a look like, yeah, I played your ass. Enjoy prison, dick, asshole. Fucking bailed. And when he goes to, like, when he says, I can't, Steve just says, help me confess. And when Simone leaves the observation room, Sipowicz is fucking with the lawyer, because the lawyer wants to know where Steve is.
This is, like, the one, I feel like this is the one scene of, like, levity and comedy through both episodes.
Other than the dick joke.
Yeah.
There is that dick joke where, is she seeing something fresh?
Well, like a good joke, let me.
Because basically he's like, where is he? And he's like, oh, I don't know. We don't know where he is. And then Simone turns around the corner and he's like, he's right there. And he's like, oh. And he's like, oh, I was in the observation room. And Simone's like, oh, I didn't think to look there.
That's funny.
And then he looks at the lawyer and he's like, yeah, Steve just confessed. He wants to write a statement right now. And then the lawyer's like, we'll see what he wants to write. And he runs over and Simone's like, I should have locked this son of a bitch in a closet. And Simone's like, oh, he can talk to him all he wants. He just admitted to me, and I'm willing to testify in court. And then, like, Simone is, like, getting out all of his anger and frustration in this speech.
Yeah.
And it's a really good fucking Jimmy Smits scene where he's, like, angry, where it's like, man, I wish he was Bruce Wayne. But, like, at one point he's like, he wants me to shoot him? He's like, no, he's gonna live a good long life so he can wake up screaming, remembering what he did. He's like, he thinks he's going to get forgiveness. He's going to burn in hell for this. And like, and then Sipowicz hears this whole speech and goes, he wanted you to shoot him? And he goes, yeah. He's like, he asked the wrong guy. Russell then comes in with the wife, who's like barely holding it together after her murderer like speech in the fucking streets. And she's like, she would like to give a statement. And then Simone was like, yeah, Steve wants to give a statement too about how he admitted to murdering and abusing Brian. And then Sherry's like, I want to say that I acted with him. I didn't protect him. And then she starts freaking out on the bench. And I have to think, in Russell's mind, even though she's a very sympathetic person, she must have just been like, fuck, again? Like, I just got you out of the stoop.
Yeah, like I just got you to calm down, bitch. Like, breathe. Like, just take a breath.
Like, man, it was like an hour ago I had you up against the wall, like, holding you together, and now, fuck, we gotta do it again. And then Sipowicz drops Psalm 119 on everybody. For some reason. I think that for the time, everybody thought it was a very profound thing and moment to do. But it kind of just seems weird, I think, to then be like...
Oh, you think? Just a little bit?
It seems weird for him to be like, hey, so that homeless guy that died because your husband framed him for this, he left this psalm, and while we're all wallowing in depression, let me just drop it on you guys, because maybe it'll make everybody feel better. And even when he finishes it, he looks at Simone and kind of gives like a shrug like, fuck, I don't know. Like, I had nothing to do this episode, so I figured I could read.
I sat here reading a Bible the whole time going, I don't know.
And then the lawyer comes back and says he wants to write a statement, and I want you to put it on the record that it's against the advice of counsel. And Simone's like, yeah, we'll include that too. And then... it just ends with everybody kind of, like, really fucking sad. And the real question I had at the end of it was, do you think Andy keeps Israel's Bible?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I thought so too. Because he came in with his own new Bible, and then he then gets Israel's, and I was like, I wonder if he keeps both Bibles. Or if he, like...
I bet you he just keeps...
Israel's?
Israel's.
Because, yeah, it'd be kind of... It's kind of crazy, like, you bought a Bible to understand what this dude means, and then possibly... Because I assumed, at the beginning of this episode, Sipowicz is like, I'm gonna talk to him. Like, I'm gonna sit down with him, we're gonna read some shit. He's gonna, like, open my mind up to what's going on here. And then when he died, he's like, fuck! I lost out on my way into this case by talking to Israel and feeding that information. And then he just became obsessed with it. So now is when I would usually wrap it up. But... we now have another 20 minutes of the show that I found out after watching it three times. Let me just kind of go over the overarching things we missed. The reason Fancy isn't around is because his daughter has a surprise appendicitis. It's mentioned in transitions that would have been in this episode in between the two different stories. And something you don't notice, they don't go to Fancy at all in this episode. But Fancy is there for a couple of scenes, and they do run down what's happening with the case with him.
Yeah.
So that's what we miss. Fancy is out because one of his daughters has an appendicitis. We also... Martinez and Medavoy get a dump job of a middle-aged white man with his hand cut off and inside of his coat pocket. Medavoy drops a joke that he thinks it's an Arab thing that he tried to steal from someone, and they cut off his hand. Everybody dismisses it immediately. The DOA was homeless, but he had nice clothes, and he had just moved in with his wife, a Mrs. Clarkin. And she basically mentions that he had come into some money through what sounds like a very intense insurance scam, because he had a job for a day and then had an accident on that job where his hand got cut off, and he was going to get a lot of money the first day he worked there. So, when they go to meet his wife, it's really a bummer that you didn't see this, because she's a shrill, horrible bitch. But, she has a moment with Greg, because Greg Medavoy is like, it sounds like you're talking about an insurance scam. And she's like, you mean to tell me I'm not going to get his benefits? What the fuck? You guys are fucking horrible. And he's like, well, yeah, you're not going to get them if it's a scam. And then she says the following, something that I think you would have gotten a huge kick out of. She goes, "It's because you're a redhead," and she's yelling in Metavoy's face right now. "Every redhead I've ever met was bad luck or some conniving type of asshole, and you're an asshole."
Jesus.
And then they, like, because normally when that happens, a detective would be like, "Hey, bitch, shut the fuck up. Now you're not going to get anything. I'm going to make sure you end up with nothing." Metavoy just kind of, like, shrivels and is like, "You have a nice day."
Oh, and, like,
so they go to the doctor's office, and it's a bummer that he's been cut off, because the doctor is Jeffrey Blake, who is a character actor who I know from the movie Brink, where he was the manager of Team X-Blades, and we don't get to see him in the Hulu episode, because I was super stoked when I saw him, because I was like, oh shit, Team X-Blades, and no one's going to get to see it.
I can't believe I missed the manager of Team X-Blades.
He plays a very evasive plastic surgeon, I think, who is not answering any of their questions, and is pretty much is very up on his rights and how they're not going to talk to him and how he's not going to give them any of their information because it's confidential. And in the middle of that conversation, a homeless man walks in without a hand, and he's upset because his wound is now infected and wants to scream at the doctor. After that thing is when they actually...
This is all the second storyline.
Yeah. This has all been cut out. And then, after that happens, this is when Fancy comes in to let everybody know that the reason he's not in is because of his family. They run... Basically, Sipowicz, Simone, and Russell run down everything that's happened so far with Fancy, which is, pretty far into the episode. And there's a moment where Fancy gives Sipowicz props for saying go forward with the lie about new evidence. Because Sipowicz basically tells them to do something really fucked up that if Fancy found out and didn't approve of would probably be bad. But Fancy, hearing the entire story, goes, that was a good idea. It's probably a good idea to now let the family sit with this information and let one of them or both of them come to you. And I think this is right before this is right before Egan came in to talk to Simone. After that is the amputee interrogation, where he's like, I don't know what's going on, I don't know what happened, I lost this because a dog bit through my hand. And they were like, okay, what kind of dog? He's like, a Rottweiler. He's like, so a Rottweiler in two bites bit through your entire hand? And you went to see this doctor? And they're like, here's the deal. I think you're caught up in a conspiracy where the people involved are going to get way more jail time than you if you admit what's going on.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So he says, okay, I'll give you the whole story. So they then go back to the doctor, who's acting like a dick, like, you got nothing. You got nothing. Nothing's happening. And then they basically lay out the entire plan in front of him, where the doctor was getting these people fake jobs with bullshit information, then performing a surgery they didn't need for an injury they didn't get on the job so that they could collect insurance from this insurance salesman who was lying about the documents to get really, really big payouts, and then they would all split the money that they get from the surgery and the benefits. They lay it out for him, and then he's like, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. And then as they leave, he's like, well, you're going to enjoy prison because they love guys like you in there that were big fancy doctors. And then he says, stop, return. And then they come back in, and they're like, so you want to tell us about this DOA? And he's like, he died in the middle of surgery. He had skin cancer on his hand, so it wasn't completely useless surgery. I won't be arrested for that. And they're like, if it's on his thumb, you didn't need to remove his whole hand. So that's bullshit. Metavoy and Martinez.
Okay.
And then he's like, look, I'll write it out to get a wrongful death in surgery rather than murder. While he's writing it out, he's like, just so you know, the patients got like 70% and I got 20. And the other guy got 10. And he's like, And they're all like, okay, that's great. Why did you get into this anyway? You were a doctor. And he's like, because of expensive women. And then he wrote out what happened. And that's all of the stuff that was taken out of this episode. Because in the middle of the investigation with the patient without the hand, that's when Sipowicz comes in to talk to a guy without a hand about being the vagrant for the sketch artist. So there is whole scenes with Jill making jokes about the doctor, Medavoy and Martinez talking about the doctor's office and how shitty it looks, talking about the scam, and it's just not in that episode. It's on the DVDs, and I think if you rip it online, you might get the full one, but it's not in Hulu.
Interesting. I wonder why it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I think my theory is a decent one. Like, maybe they just didn't HD up the whole thing, and they were like, well, we're not going to put in a garbage version in the middle of all these other episodes.
Yeah.
But,
like, they only had, like you were saying, they only had, like, the made-for-TV version or something.
So who knows?
That's not a bad theory.
Anything about this episode, now that you know that you watched a bastardized version of it?
The mom's acting's ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely outrageous sometimes.
It's like she just, like, needed to rein it in a little bit.
And I understand, and I think, like, it might be interpreted as, like, you don't get what it's like for a mother to lose their child. It's like, no, I get that. But at some point, what she was doing got a little ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, like, at some point, we get it.
Well, no like, because I understand, like, okay, it happened. Because there's been a lot of performances on NYPD Blue where people find out, like, their son has been killed, or, like, a family member has been killed. And, like, they convey that same emotion without doing that kind of shit.
That's true. That's true.
So, like, murderer, you tear him apart. It was very Nicolas Cage and meets Tommy Wiseau from The Room.
She was decent in the first episode, too. Like, she wasn't so campy and, like, crazy. It's weird.
And I think the Steve Egan guy, I think he just saw the opportunity of, like, really chewing up the screen.
I don't know what happened there. That went downhill so fast.
And what sucks is, I think this episode has a lot going against it because it cut out the other stuff that grounds the episode as an NYPD Blue episode. Because,
okay.
Like, if you had, because it cut out that entire story, but it also cut out transitions, like little moments that remind you there are other people in this story.
Fair enough.
Like, acknowledgments of, like, Martinez and Medavoy, acknowledgments of Fancy, acknowledgments of Naomi, even. And, like, all we have are the big three, Sipowicz, Russell, Simone. All we have are the Egans and their lawyer, and all we have is their crazy over-the-top acting. So that's literally all you have to watch. Whereas if you had the full hour version, you're like, oh yeah, and then we have this story, like there's other non-crazy shit happening, even though it's about an insurance scam with people cutting off hands.
Which is kind of, I think, a pretty interesting story now that you're telling me it.
And like, because for the first half of it, you're like, what the fuck's going on? People, like, he was found with his hand in his pocket? Like,
which
why?
Which now that I think about it, I vaguely remember seeing that. So I feel like I have seen
that version of it?
Yeah, I just done it a long time ago, but I vaguely remember that.
I think cutting it has hurt it a lot, especially when you watch it after an episode that has Israel in it, and he's doing such a fucking good job.
Yeah,
that
he is a pretty good. He does kind of carry that first episode for sure.
And once he's removed, it's kind of like, oh yeah, we're dealing with these like cartoonish reactions to some things. So that's the most controversial episode of NYPD Blue that we've dealt with because there's different versions and it's crazy. You have anything to say about it before we wrap up this overlong episode?
No, I think I've said what needs to be said.
Alrighty. Every single episode of NYPD Blue Balls is on AsherBrothersPodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, where you find your podcasts. We're on Twitter at AsherBrosPod, Instagram at AsherBrothersPodcast, where we mostly announce new episodes of the show, well, of our podcast, and we'll talk about the show if you want to talk about it. I'm sure we missed things about this episode specifically, so you can contact us there. Have a good one. Stay safe. Wash your hands. don't touch your face, and keep watching NYPD Blue at home.
I'll touch who the fuck I want to touch.
It's your right as an American.
As a God-given American.
Thank you once again for listening to NYPD Blue Balls. If you could do us a favor, please rate and review NYPD Blue Balls on whatever format you're using to listen to it, unless it's AstroBrothersPodcast.com, because we have no rating system. But on those platforms, it'll get it into the algorithm. More people might see the podcast, and more importantly, start watching NYPD Blue, which is currently only on Hulu, no longer on Amazon. If you need more NYPD Blue goodness in your life, there's Gene Kendall's book, An Unofficial Guide to NYPD Blue. That's on Amazon for, I believe, 99 cents. There is What Would Sipowicz Do?, a collection of articles written about the show from people from all types of walks of life. And, of course, there is True Blue, a book written about the first couple seasons by creators and consultants. That should keep you busy during this quarantine. That's still hopefully going on. Hopefully you stay safe as things start to open. Keep washing your hands, keep covering your face, and be smart out there, and be safe. Have a good one. Bye.